Hi, everyone. My name is Dr. Deb Roberts, and I am the host for Season 2 of the Mind Medicine Australia's podcast. Before we begin with this week's guest, a reminder that Mind Medicine Australia's focus is on the development and the use of evidence-based psychedelic-assisted therapies within regulated healthcare systems. We do not, though, encourage the use of psychedelic medicines outside of this context, and we do not support the use of these substances in any way that is unlawful. This podcast is intended for educational purposes only. None of the content herein constitutes medical advice. Guests' views are their own and do not represent the views of Mind Medicine Australia, and individuals need to discuss their individual healthcare needs with their healthcare providers. Thank you for listening. So welcome to the Mind Medicine Podcast, Season 2, Megan Smoke. Thank you for joining me today. My hands are in that kind of, I get excited as I start these interviews or conversations, I like to call them. So I hope that is what we have today. But I thought, so welcome to the program.
Lovely to be here.
And before we start, you might have either listened before, as I've begin these opportunities to speak with what I already think will be an incredible kind of opportunity just to talk about real topics around humanity, consciousness, well-being. I like to start with my feet on the ground. So disclosure, my feet are out of my shoes and my feet are literally planted on the ground. And that's for me to be grounded. And it's an opportunity perhaps for you and anyone listening, if that isn't in locomotion and moving, to just kind of settle into the space. Seated here, there is an opportunity also to support, I suppose, the conversation by allowing the kind of periphery, I don't know, sometimes it's kind of gunk or residue to kind of clear. So anyone listening can either, if they have the opportunity, just to close the eyes for a moment, if not, just kind of allowing the breath to mediate the kind of sometimes frenetic mind and or sensations in the body, which tells us that we're human, of course, but sometimes the settling can just allow for perhaps a richer and even deeper conversation today. So as we take the next breath or two, allowing the eyes, if they are closed, just to flutter open. And I would love to, instead of introducing you per se, myself, I like to start, Megan, with what are you connected to? Do you feel connected to just at present?
Goodness me, that is an open question, if ever there was one. What do I feel connected to? In this moment, I can feel my feet on the floor. So in the immediate sense, I feel connected to the wood of my house. I feel connected to, I'm going to go straight into the deep. It's such an open question. Goodness me. So I feel connected to my life, and I feel connected to my life in a way that I don't think I've ever experienced prior to the last, well, obviously it's prior to this moment, because that's the only moment we have to experience. But I'd say there's been a radical deepening of my connection to life, and life is an all-encompassing term that's holding my child, my work, my community, my presence, the learning that I've been able to be privileged to have through the CPAT training I did recently, and all the people around me. That's my connection right now.
No, thank you. Yes, thank you. It's interesting because it's a question that has been asked truly in the most open way. And I suppose I ask in also disclosure that without connection. I feel that you know, humanity is at a loss, and that is when really serious things occur. And you might have already listened to, but just in also just connecting with you literally right now in our conversation, the lack of connection. So in when we don't have connection, is something that I had recently, because my sister ended her life about a year ago, November, which people who have listened to this have hear this most times, but it is a it's something that's it's a perplexing and really just an interesting line of questioning in the most open way of how we feel connected, whether that be to self, to others, as you have you know, individually, you know, answered for yourself in this moment. So thank you for starting in the deep end in a way, and being also open to just answering in that way. So there isn't a right or wrong. And I wonder if now, just a little bit of background, where we are going to talk about generally, you know, well-being in its broadest sense. And that can be almost synonymous with how we are feeling physically and or mentally at any one time. And I wondered, without because we are going to talk about some different things, whether as an introduction for yourself, whether you might, for listeners who haven't read your bio, just to give a little bit of background of what you feel like in regards to just perhaps maybe just a little bit about yourself that you would like to share with listeners.
Okay. Well, the full disclosure again, I haven't prepared for this, so I'm going for the conversational way, so I'm sure I'll miss things out. Me, in terms of what people in the context of health and well-being might want to know about me and who I am and how to locate me. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, where do I start?
At the beginning. You don't have to
start at the beginning. Yeah, no way. I don't think I can ever do that. Like, I always start in the middle, then jump out to the side, then circle around, and then I go back all over the place. So I'll start in one of the most important parts of my well-being, which is I'm a mother. So I'm a single parent to an 11-year-old, and that is a whole avenue of well-being, joy and challenge in life, as any parent knows. I'm an educator, I'm a clinical psychologist, I'm a long-term meditator, I'm a person who is living and managing MS in my life. And so consequently, I'm somebody who has lots and lots of physical challenges, and I, whenever I have a new client come into my room, particularly a kid, I have the most fun with kids when they come into my room. They come in, they sit down and say, oh, you saw I just had a walking stick when I was coming to see you. Sometimes it's two. And then I show them how the walking sticks like can collapse and unfold and stuff. And then I've got a wheelchair that actually got a remote control. So sometimes if the wheelchair's in the room, we can play with that as well. And it's like I've got this amazing like toy car in the room, and then it's great fun and that kind of thing. So I'm a person that has the joys and the challenges of navigating life as a single parent, until very recently as an educator, a lecturer at the local university, UTAS, and clinical supervisor there, and private practice doing clinical supervision, as well as seeing clients across the lifespan. And I try to do other things in my life that are nourishing and more hobby focused, but until recently it was just breathing was basically the challenge. So yeah, that's kind of, I guess it's a snapshot. I'm sure I've left things out.
Well, that's it sounds very full to me, and I think that you've touched on a lot of different aspects of how we navigate moments in time, different ages and stages. I wonder, for listeners, perhaps how you came into, it's an interest of my own. So it's, you know, I kind of, it's a kind of a laser to it. But in terms of meditating, you said you've been a long-term meditator. I wonder how that journey, perhaps, if we start with that, how that may have started, or the need or want and exposure to that, and how that has kind of threaded through life to now, if you're happy to go there.
Absolutely. It's really thematic for this particular conversation as well, because I was exposed to meditation when I was 17 years old, and I had had shocking depression. And I was one of those teenagers that I was, you know, I was in a private school on scholarship, and I was in the rowing team, and I was in the debate team, and I was in the orchestra, and I was in the netball team, and I was house captain, and I was joint deputy senior prefect of the school, and I did cross-age tutoring, and I was the person that would trot out to like introduce someone to the school, and this is it. I would do the whole hello and welcome to the school, blah de blah de blah. I was involved in everything. And you get these pockets in private schools where you get all like your colours and the things that you're involved in. I literally, they had to order a larger pocket for me because there were so many teams and things that I was involved in, because my home life was horrible. So by the time I got to year 12 for the leavers day, I was drinking at school.
Yeah.
So I was on academic scholarship, and I was in the accelerated maths program and all that sort of thing, but I couldn't keep it up. I was drunk many days at school. And by the time, and I was drunk for a couple of my year 12 exams, and by the leavers day, I was lucky to not fall off the stage. I was absolutely maggoted. I remember before a physics class in year 11 or 12, taking shots of, it was either gin or some kind of white alcohol, and feeling my stomach flip, and I couldn't work out why. It was first thing in the morning and I hadn't had breakfast, and I was sculling raw alcohol from a bottle at my locker. And so I wasn't very happy. And I ended up in a very, very, very bad place. And I won't go into the details of the bad place, but the short version of that is I ended up having the privilege of being introduced to a psychiatrist who taught transcendental meditation. And so that was my first taste of meditating. And I think, yeah, I'm 17, 18. I think actually I was 19 by the time I met him, 19. So the first thing sort of started, and I tried a few bits and bobs, but didn't really understand it. And to me, meditation was this weird concept. It was nothing I was remotely interested in. When he told me he wanted to teach me to meditate, I was so just like, yeah, whatever. I don't know, yeah, whatever. And then I kept interrupting. And then he said, this is a very natural process. And so he taught me, I said, can I drink water in the middle? He goes, you can do whatever you want. Can I go to the toilet? You can. He was very patient. And I pushed the parameters. And so I was a TM meditator for quite some time, and it was brilliant. And I would describe it to people, it's jogging for your brain. There's nothing mystical about it. You sit down, you do it, and you learn how to get your brain to actually calm. And it was so nice, because what I didn't know until very recently is that I have ADHD.
Okay.
Had I known that, a lot of things might have been different in my youth and high school and all through university and everything, like many, many people that weren't diagnosed when they were young. Hence, doing so much stuff, I couldn't sit still. I couldn't be. I couldn't emotionally self-regulate. I couldn't have the skills that were needed to be able to navigate life as a high functioning neurodivergent person. So instead I just got really super busy. I could never check over my work because I couldn't sit still and concentrate. But fortunately enough, I just was a really super fast processor, and I just go, well, if I get it first time, good. And I was able to function enough. So going through the years, I tried various forms of meditation at various points of mental health crisis, basically. Because the TM didn't solve everything, and I still had the trickiness with my family, the trickiness with my mental health, and ADHD. So I put myself at risk again and again and again. And so sometimes that meant that I ended up in very, very bad situations. Yeah. And, yeah. And so I've tried all different types of meditation with various, you know, degrees of success. And then about 3.5 years ago, I had a situation in my life where I just moved down to Tasmania, so I'm in a totally new city. I'm married, and my husband has been studying medicine ever since before, just after we got together. I took him to an open day for University of Sydney, and he went, oh, yes, medicine, maybe I'll do that. And he's a very, very bright man. So he enrolled in medicine, and this is what we were doing for 12 years. And then finally, and so we moved to Tasmania, and and that's where I am now. I'm in Launceston still. And he finally got to his final year, and it was lots of hiccups and things along the way. And so his mental health really suffered from it and all that sort of thing. And there was lots of support toward him. And we finally got towards the end, and then my dad got really sick. And so we'd been here in Tasmania for just a year at that point, and my father was so sick. And then on the day that my husband had their final exam, my father got admitted to hospital, and dad never came out. So that was the last hospital admission. My father died. My husband ended up in bed with Epstein-Barr virus about a month later. Got fellowship for general practice. Finally, all the exams done, everything done. Finally, our journey is done while he was in bed with Epstein-Barr virus. And then he got out of bed and said, I'm done. I want a divorce. And during that time, my dad has just died. I just got my first wheelchair, and he decides he's done. He wants a divorce. And COVID hits. And so, in amongst COVID, that's when he says, I'm done. I want a divorce. So I'm on my own, suddenly, single mum. COVID's hit. I can't hug anyone. I can't be with anyone. I'm in a new town. I can't see my family because we're in lockdown in Tasmania. We were the first state to go into lockdown. We couldn't see anybody. Then my family's all in Melbourne. They went into lockdown when we came out of lockdown. And so there was nobody. And my brother said, you need to read Michael Singer. And so I read Michael Singer, the Jewish yogi from the Temple of the Universe in Florida. And Michael Singer said, when your life completely falls apart, when everything is destroyed, use it to go to God. So at that point in my life, when I had absolutely nothing and I didn't know what to do, I used it to go to God. I started meditating, and I meditated my ass off, and it kept me alive.
And when you say meditated my ass off, how did that go in terms of obviously a commitment again to a connection, right? Like we started this conversation, a connection to something, whether it be connection to self, some, connection to a higher order. How did that translate with meditating your ass off, literally.
Well,
Sounds harsh. It sounds harsh, Megan. But it tell me what that, how did that translate? Not translate, how did that happen practically? You were
totally. I couldn't connect to self. There was no self left because everything, like I was the doctor's wife, I had been doing everything to get him over the line. So my own identity had, and there's a lot of story in there as well, but I'm not going to go into any of that. Like, we'll stick this to like the health and well-being and mental health and meditation. So there was not much of me there, and I have a beautiful, actually a slight divergence. I have a beautiful neighbor. She's like 6 foot 2. She's from Zimbabwe, and well, she's not my neighbor anymore. She's left. But she said, when I first met you, you told me that you were an Aries. And I thought, this woman is lying. I was like, I'm sorry, you thought I was a lie. No. I thought you were so sweet and so lovely. You were so kind and very softly spoken and very quiet and so tuned into emotions. And you could really read what anyone would need, and you could sense anything for your husband or anything. She goes, now I just think, yeah, you weren't you. I see an Aries now. Before you were like this crushed little bossy. And I'm like, I don't even know what that means, but there you go. Gives you a sense of what was sort of going on. But now I'm an Aries, apparently. Anyway, the meditation. I had nothing to lean on. I had no personhood to actually hold me up. And so I thought, I can't trust myself, and I have no center, and I have nothing to be tethered to. And so I pulled out biofeedback to start with so that I could just use that. So I just did basically a Vipassana-ish type meditation, bare minimum, bare bones, but I made sure I bookended my day with minimum 15 minutes, usually 20, but minimum morning and night 15 minutes. And if I couldn't hold it together and if I doubted, I used biofeedback to make sure that I was actually on track. Interestingly enough, I also was teaching meditation to patients during the day. So I had spot meditations all throughout the day, every day, and I couldn't sleep. So I would use good old Insight Timer and various forms of meditation there. So I was, that's what I meant by meditating my ass off. Absolutely strict morning and night, no matter what else, I would bookend, and all the rest was just this other meditations just dripping into my day.
That's interesting. I'm reflecting as I hear that, thinking back to my sister who, because I had found personally yoga and the physicality of yoga, but of course ultimately it's about helping the fluctuations in your mind and then teaching yoga and meditation and my sister again in that kind of connectivity. Wanted to feel connected to something, practice. And what made me think when you were talking about literally practicing your ass off, and I like that because what you actually were meaning is there was discipline and tenacity with making sure that those practices were daily and it became a habit. And I think that people listening as well who would love to have the discipline and make those habit patterns and yet find challenge in building that. It sounds as though discipline and the kind of tenacity of building habit patterns isn't something that or is something that comes easily to you.
Say that it doesn't feel like it to me. I feel like I'm so bad at it that I have to do it, which is a weird thing to say. So it's one of those things where I made it small. I think when I first started, it might have been 5 minutes morning and night. And so what I do is I put a placeholder in my day. So I put a placeholder that I then expand. See, now I do an hour and a half morning and an hour and a half night, right? But there's no way in hell that I could have done that before. It was very much starting small. So it's like I can brush my teeth morning and night, and I've done that for 49 years. Well, probably not 49 because I didn't do that when I was zero, but I've done that for well over 40 years, morning and night brushing my teeth. And I thought, I'm just going to build on that. So I'll brush my teeth and I'll meditate. That's all I did.
Yeah, I think that the intrigue in that, and hearing some of your story, and some of the challenges that you were just disclosing, the opportunity to connect to something and through breath, which we have from when we're born, right? And yet it is. To sit with ourselves can be a very lonely and heart challenging time when the mind doesn't stop. Yet, of course, as I asked you about meditation and our even concepts about meditation might differ, but in general, around the noise of the mind isn't our whole self. The mind is one part of us, not all of us. And I remember one of a teacher telling me that when I was unwell, was probably more the anxiety, had in generalized anxiety, but that then going to emotional exhaustion, and then that leading to depression and not able to function. And she distinguished, you know, something is wrong with your mind, not something isn't wrong with you and your essence. And that distinction was an important, it was just an important learning or reminder. And yet I think as you are talking of my sister as an example of having such a challenge, you know, when you are unwell, to be able to cultivate. And what you're saying is obviously starting small, and that, you know, is something she did, you know, try as well, and didn't seem that she could connect to it. And we, you know, we both know, and anyone listening, there isn't one, you know, people meditate through running at marathons, or people meditate through dancing, and people meditate through really hard, challenging intellectual academic work, so to speak, if you can drop into that kind of flow state. I never can remember his name, but the guy that Mikhail.
We know the one. I just go, you know, the one with a really long name, lots of letters.
A really long name. Yeah. So we'll go with that. Yeah. Respect to him. So just with the, I guess, as we're threading with the meditation aspect, in terms of people who are, I guess, more toward the pointy end of being unwell, whether through physicality, through chronic illness, and or being mentally, getting to a place where the, mentally in the mind state isn't well. What are your thoughts? I know you as a clinical psychologist, as well as your own experience, in terms of how we are contending with the tools that we have at present with when people's mind, you know, really isn't, the brain and the chemistry isn't working in a well state. I don't, without going into, I don't want to get too much into the kind of neurolinguistic aspects, but in terms of how, what are your thoughts in terms of really dealing with the unwell mind?
Okay, so the question is basically, in the context of meditation, what are my thoughts of dealing with the unwell mind? Is that right?
Yeah. Can we, when our mind really is unwell, and this might lead us, you know, psychedelic assisted therapy, of course, in one sense, can be a tool to help brain function to then have integration, so to speak, after. But I don't necessarily, we don't have to go down that line necessarily. But for a mind that's unwell, and the relationship with meditation, or the potential of trying to still the mind, I just wondered what your thoughts are when people are unwell, and the potential of meditation, or where to start.
That's, again, that's a big question, obviously, and multifaceted. So we're looking at, first of all, we're starting with this idea of how to still the mind. I want to start with that because I say, don't try. Just drop that straight away. That shit's got to go. Like, so when somebody has a very unwell mind, or when anybody has mental distress, to try to still the mind is to ask someone to have torture and to experience failure repeatedly. So I just, when I am teaching meditation, when I'm meditating myself, people say, I can't meditate because I can't quiet my mind. I'm like, let's just have a go. And they do it. And then I talk them through what their experience was. And they say, but my mind was drifting. I'm like, how did you know? So, well, I could see my thought was over there. I was like, what part of you could see the thought over there? Like, what do you mean? It was me. I'm like, great, but the thought was over there. And then you came back, right? That arc, that moment of arcing back, that's meditation. You've done this perfectly. You're able to see your thought going away. Go you, check it out. And so then we just work on that. We work on building that muscle of arcing back. And people go, ooh, I can meditate. And so we go from there. And particularly I work a lot with people with ADHD. And I say, I don't want to tell you to quiet your mind to one thought. That's to stop your magnificence. Let's get multi-channel awareness, get all these things input, just make it proximal to now. So hear the intercooler in the background. Wonderful, but don't go, I wonder what year that car is built. No, that's an intercooler. Fine, label, come back. your voice has come back. That's it. So for me, it's not about stilling the mind. It's about bringing people to that moment in time and use whatever juicy information helps you come back to the moment in time. Does that make sense?
Totally. And I think that it's such a it's a really important reminder, because I again with these conversations, I tend to go back to here as an example, my sister who ended her life. Where were these points where she kept, as an example, and I think she's not alone, oh, I'm failing at, I'm not doing it right. And she felt that way about yoga as well. And for she was very mobile, like her, the way she could sit in Padmasana and all that. I couldn't, and I've been doing it for 30 years. But she didn't, it was, it's like we're, it's missing the point with what we're trying to kind of be within a present moment. Like we started with that question of connection. You did go to the ground, you know, or the literal, the unembodied. And I don't want to use too much language in the sense of just for just anyone to be able to understand the idea to be connected to a present moment awareness. If that present moment awareness, though, is also misery.
That's the next part of the question.
Yeah,
Yeah.
great. Yes, please.
So I wanted to go to that as well because for me, when I started meditating during that time where my whole life had kind of imploded, it was awful. And I'm trying to not use swears, but
You swears.
it was fucking awful. It was so bad. It was torture. It was so horrible being me. I hated it. All my dreams had gone. All of my future plans had gone. Being in my own body hurt. I ached for, I'd been wrapped every night in this other person's body, and I suddenly, it was gone. And so I was lonely. I was cold. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't think. And then when I was awake, I was panicking. What am I going to do? You know, how am I going to support myself? I wasn't supposed to work more than one day a week. And my MS employment support coordinator was just like, you know, you probably got maybe 2 years left of work left in you and that kind of stuff. So I'm having this whole idea of what am I going to do? How am I going to survive all this? And so then it's like, well, let's meditate. You know, sit down, shut my eyes. Great. My big screen TV of catastrophe is like playing the highlights of terror constantly. And so for me to be in that and still choose to meditate was the framework was, all right, so I'll be aware to this. This is fucking awful. Hope this stops soon. Better just sort of stay with it. It was so bad. And that's why I got the biofeedback out because I thought, my thoughts are absolute shit and I can't make them stop. How about I just make sure that my heart rate variability stays in like within this little sort of range? And then I stopped fighting with my thoughts. I just went, ah, oh, right. I'm not going to have peace. I'm not going to have lovely thoughts because my life's a freaking mess. I'm not actually going to have stillness or this lovely, juicy sense of, oh, I'm going to have ease within that. So I'm going to sit down and be tortured for 5 minutes, but I'm going to get better at viewing the torture and going, all right, next horrible scene and the next torturous scene and the next and the next. If I felt myself go and get picked up by a scene and then do it all, the second that I recognized that I'd got picked up and left, I had to go, you've done okay. But even that kind of kindness, weirdly, at that point in my life, it felt like a stab. Being kind to myself felt awful. It was so torturous. I couldn't even be kind because I was so stuck in that state that it was a self-torture to be kind. And I'm a mindful self-compassion teacher, for heaven's sake. Like I teach this stuff. And so what I ended up doing also was I threw myself into my work. And not everyone can do that. Because I'm a therapist, so I was going every day and teaching people skills. And so I had to be like, blah, 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 stuff that I'm not doing. And so then I started to listen to it and be with people in their misery. And because you've got different compartments in your brain, I got a break. Because when I was a therapist, I had to put my stuff on hold.
Yes.
And so I got a break by not being the tortured person and being there and teaching other people. And sometimes a tortured person came into the room. And I'd get a little bit overwhelmed. And so I would literally sleep in between patients at that point. And I was so exhausted and I had nothing to give. But I was in the privileged position where I had to teach meditation and I had to listen to other people's suffering, common humanity, left, right, and center. So I can't, for moments of every day, hours actually, of every day, I had to sit and witness other people's suffering and other people's joy and that sort of thing. And so see the full spectrum of humanity from this crumpled person's perspective. And be able to bring my actual competent therapist self into that domain. So I was in a fairly privileged position that way.
It's interesting you being in a privileged position, and yet there was so much going on. It makes me think a friend of mine, I remember in India doing yoga. I was doing it just what I had my own practice, and it was a best friend of mine who knew me well, and she said, and it caught me, it touched me at that point because I didn't had hadn't realized, but she said, I watch you doing the practice. And she found it was, she used the word punishing, that it was as if I was punishing. It looked punishing, I think is what she was saying. I thought I was just doing my, strong practice, but it made me think when you were talking about the kind of, and we're using kind of these words, torture, or, and of course we're talking relative, but real to us, or what is looks like is punishing. Internally, there wasn't any compassion going on, and I'm sure I know, as you are a teacher in this area, Kristen Neff's work with self-compassion. She really brought some of that lexicon to us, and probably about 10 years ago was when I was introduced by one of my yoga teachers, who was kind of thinking, well, this is a component that you could probably work with. And the even idea of compassion, a new one, that same best friend recently said to me, which also is challenging, is tender, to be tender. That was also like punch. Pitchfork in my heart, even though I am slowly listening to that again. So yes, please go on. But I'm resonating with that tussle, fighting. And it sounds as though there's been some, with your teaching, ways in which you are then slowly letting that maybe seep in, or allowing some of that to that compassion aspect to be part of your own internal work.
Look, absolutely. Like I said, I'm in a really lucky position in some ways in my life because I was able to just go, this is not working. I'm not surviving. I'm actually going down the drain. I'd connected to a beautiful person who was a really good friend, and she was saying that she had COVID tummy because her tummy was so upset all the time and she was just so stressed. And she's saying, it's because of COVID and everything's stressing me out. And I said, yeah, I've got a broken heart. This is like really upsetting me and I've got a broken heart and everything's really bad. And then both of us ended up having our doctors say, you need some scans because you might have cancer. And so that was a bit of a shock. And unfortunately enough, my friend had bowel cancer. And my scans and tests went on for longer because I didn't have cancer. They thought I had lymphoma. I just had menopause and a broken heart. So I was having night sweats and I was so stressed and I was eating really healthily and regularly because I was being very responsible and doing what I should, but I lost like 10 kilos. I ended up massively underweight no matter what I did. And so then I started getting salivation syndrome brain. And so I literally went to my GP and I said, I am having thoughts that I see in the girls that I treat for eating disorders. I'm having those thoughts. Like I literally weigh, like I weighed 52 kilos and I'm 170 centimeters tall, right? And I said, I don't need to lose weight, but now I look at my dinner and think, oh gosh, do I really need to eat all that? And my part of my brain says, yes, you do, get that into you. And the other part of my brain says, no, you could probably lose a few more kilos. And so I have this argument with myself. And so I said to the doctor, please, I need to go on antidepressants. Because I also was very sad as well, very, very sad at that time. And she's like, well, I think you're doing great. You're doing all these practices. You don't need antidepressants. You're just sad. You've had this horrible thing in your life. I'm like, I am basically suicidal. And now I'm developing anorexia. And I don't want either of those things. I need these antidepressants. And she's like, da-da, this, that. It took 3 visits. And I said, I want this one because it's Valdoxan. It's got very few side effects. It's got all these, except for the stuff, the side effects will make me sleep more and make me eat more. And I want those. I want both of those, please. Anyway, I went on it for like 6 months to help lift me out of the pit. And that's one of the things I wanted to talk about is I'm very much of the if there's something that can help, get it. I need people to sleep well. I need them to eat well. I need them to be able to do their exercise. I need them to get whatever support they can from any kind of pharmaceutical, a standard antidepressant, a non-standard antidepressant, a psychedelic, anything. But I do feel like I've just left Rachel hanging. Rachel got diagnosed. Rachel and I became supports for each other. Rachel didn't make it. So that triggered in me a, I ended up organizing to teach a mindful self-compassion course. So I
Got it.
did.
Keep getting goosebumps with these interviews that, yeah.
So I, in sitting with other people's pain and difficulty and helping them to find their own relationship to self-compassion, I was able to, and in organizing, doing all of that, and writing stories for Rachel when I went and had this really amusing things that happen in my life. I tend to end up in really silly situations. And so Rachel asked me to write her stories while she was still with us. And so I did. I wrote some things and we had that kind of connection. So then after she passed, I ended up teaching mindful self-compassion and being able to heal lots of things there when I had the privilege of holding other people as they're being in their tentative steps into meditation and their own healing and their own work. So again, very privileged position for me where I'm able to do that. And there's not that many people that have the opportunity to say, oh, if I'm having some internal crisis, how about I just teach a course that I've been trained in? You know, like I'm very lucky in that way.
Yeah, and I hear that, and you saying that being privileged, and I hear that you saying that, but you had a hell of a lot of shit things going on as well, and the fact that you were teaching, it was like be the change you want to see in the world. I guess I am just listening to you, and it sounds like the way in which you went about it, sounds quite incredible in that regard. Where, as you said, yes, you were feeling like you were falling apart, and you were supporting a good friend, of course, as well, but also in patients. And then from someone passing, and this almost goes a bit of full circle, even of having this conversation. Someone passing, just like we were talking about the breath, when someone stops breathing and they pass, there are there it's yet another crossroad, or it's a how do we make our purpose or those questions of why we're here more, I don't know, just it's more present, literally present, back to the connection aspect. And it's interesting, I'm sitting in a chair, and you are too. I remember my long ago, and you would know this as a clinical psychologist, a lot of people might have heard this, but when trying to be compassionate, starting with my sister used to say, imagine, and she used me or a best friend, she's like, imagine Debbie. To me, if I was my sister, Stephanie, in the next chair, and how you would speak to, a friend or your loved one, and the way in which you would speak, very different from how you speak to your to oneself. Now, anyone that's along the pathway of some kind of therapeutic having some therapy on some level, or even just what's available, luckily in society today, the self-compassion piece, the way in which you communicate, the dialogue with yourself, you would never speak to, you know, your loved one. Or my sister used to say, you know, put me in that chair. And, you know, someone had taught her that technique. But then when it is you in that chair, like I'm looking at you, and, you know, it's, we are seeing a reflection, like you're having your own dialogue in your head about me communicating. Someone listening to this is having their own reflective, perhaps, or judgmental, or whatever might be going on in someone's head. And yeah, I'm intrigued with, yeah, again, the kind of tenacity and the work ethic that you've been able to, even when you were younger, you know, you were talked about all those different roles you had, and yet you were having the issues at home and the drinking. So self-punishing ways, sorry, numbing ways and coping ways, right? Anyone that has an alcoholic issue or knows someone, it's because of pain.
Self-medicating.
So please, just please go on.
I'm not sure where to pick that one up, but I'll come in on the self-compassion one, shall I? So self-compassion is a really tricky one, like you've described, of that feeling of stabbing. And I use that too. And when I'm working with people with self-compassion, I've learned now to really titrate it. And the beautiful thing is IFS, so internal family systems theory, and self-compassion are the most beautiful tools to work together. Because when you're trying to teach self-compassion, sometimes it feels like you're trying to like hammer at something that's just going to bounce straight back. It's opposing magnets coming up against each other. And that chair work you described can be good, but people still in that moment of trying to bring themselves into that chair, like you said, it's too much. But when I do that chair work, that literal kind of chair work, but then ask them, can you find a part of you that would benefit from some compassion? And can you find a part of you that wants to be compassionate to something? Nothing inside yourself yet. Find that compassionate part. And that compassionate part, can they bring some compassion to this part that's suffering? Not all of you, just that part. I've described that quite badly, but it works very powerfully.
No, I like the, that aspect of titrating, I think, is a very, that makes, I think that makes a lot of sense to people, especially who might even hear, I remember hearing self-compassion. I wouldn't even want to say it really out loud, that, you know, maybe 10 years ago, you know, in that first beginning of like, well, maybe look at this work. And it seemed like, oh my God, gosh, you're, you know, it's not accessible. And what you're saying is the way in which, if there are parts of ourselves or a part of us when we were younger or now, but sometimes when you are thinking of a younger person, there's often, I think we generally have more empathy for younger, you know, people because they're more, you know, they can't care for themselves. So that to me makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. It's a beautiful one when you're working with the younger self. So when we're using IFS as a model, we've got our managers, our firefighters, and our exiles. And our exiles are that's the trauma, right? So if you've got a trauma part of you that's usually very, very young, and if you say to someone, be compassionate towards that exile, that's the magnet. That's just going to bounce straight off. So even though that's a part within a person, being compassionate to that whole part can be too much sometimes. So it's like, is there a part of that part that you feel that you could soften and be compassionate towards? And it's even taking a step back and do you think you could find the intention to perhaps be compassionate towards this part of that part? And to just really soften and open things up in this very stepwise way. And I think me 5 years ago, if I heard somebody say what I just said, I'd think, oh, bloody hell. You know, what are you doing? Is there a part, probably a thing of that bit? You're not going to get anywhere. It's amazing, though. When I work with Girls, mostly I work with girls with eating disorders. I just haven't had many males come through. That's why I'm gendering this space, just because I'm talking from my clinical experience. It helps me to have a model in my head of people. And when I've been working with these girls, having that tentative opening up, it's like, and I've used this analogy to people before, it's like you've just turned the temperature up in the room in the most gentle way. And unknowingly, that being a part, a probably, can you just to that part, that's a slight raising of the temperature. It's warming things up. And so the shield of ice around these things that are just impenetrable starts to just melt away slightly, and everything starts to soften. And so what we find is then all of a sudden things just open right up. Whereas if you come straight in at it, it just doesn't really work.
That makes a lot of sense. Just to perhaps get your thoughts on the, we were talking about in the tools and the resources for people who are actually unwell, we were talking about the notion of what is available and perhaps maybe now connecting in with the psychedelic space, if you feel that that feels right to connect to that, just in the sense of what is, what are the options out there at present in our literal live moment at this point? It's November, sorry, December 8th, as we're, filming this, but just in your what you think the state of affairs are at the moment in terms of what is available and potentially this the potential of psychedelics in this space of treating the unwell.
Okay,
And
so
well, I've just put that in the unwell category. I know that it's not simply just people who are unwell, but I tend to, I mean, I think that that is where there is, I mean, we cannot shy away from the statistics of what's happening in the mental health space, including, eight suicides a day in Australia alone. So I do tend to connect on this pointy end, but you're welcome to kind of broaden that out. But that's, I just, your thoughts on that space in the mental, the resources and tools available.
I'm going to start small and then amp up into the other stuff. So, first point for resources available when somebody's in that really poor mental health state, if it's from an event that's happened, or if it's from you've got an awareness of something, a script that's going on, I always talk to people about counter brainwashing. Usually, if we're in a bad space, we've got that inner critic, that inner voice, that inner whatever's going on. So we've got something on loop. And so I remember when part of when I was going through my journey, I had Sarah Blondin every night. I would go to bed listening to Sarah Blondin recording, and she would just talk through basically when seeing change, when change, when your whole life explodes and there's this chasm in front of you, then there's this, this capacity for new things to come into there. And this could be an amazing moment of growth. And I'm completely misquoting her, but like there's this basically, and it's a with this music in the background. And so I've got on repeat in my own head, your life's a disaster, you've lost everything, and that's terrible. You're devastated, you're bad, nothing can go forward. And so I literally chose to put Sarah Blondin in as an earworm every single night. And sometimes when I'd be like falling asleep between patients in my office, thank goodness I'm a therapist, I've got a couch, right? So lie down on the couch, listen to Sarah Blondin. And I would take that time to just because I couldn't stop my mind to put something else in, to fill that space when I didn't have the capacity to do it. So it was like it was an assistive living device for my consciousness. So somebody else is doing the script for a while. So if you pick something that's useful that you can actually kind of believe a little bit, even just a tiny bit, or have that intention to maybe believe it one day, that kind of tentative engagement, then you just, if you just have that, that's just a real practical way of sort of having a step to crack something open, to try to rewrite some scripts, not to then suddenly walk out and go, I can like rule the universe, but to have this thing of softening your own script and also giving your psyche a break from it. So I think with, so amping up on the question, so I think psychedelics come in on that level of that reset. So I'm talking about we're trying to give our mind a break. Well, from the, so the full disclosure here, like I told you before, Deb, when we were just chatting just before this started recording, that I'm actually psychedelic naive. So I got into psychedelics. Do you mind? I do slight divergence of how I got into psychedelics, and I'll loop back to this. All right, thumbs up. Cool. I got into psychedelics through experiencing very profound altered states of consciousness through meditation. So I, and which we can talk about later if you're interested, but it was through that that I went, what the hell is going on? And so then I actually started reading into things, and then I was like, goodness me, look at this. Psychedelics do this reliably with a pill. And so that really piqued my interest, and that's how I ended up on this psychedelic journey as a practitioner. But I still myself have not yet taken psychedelics, which is the situation that I'm going to remedy at the MMA, one of the MMA trips to Amsterdam. There's one coming up at the end of February, start of March, and I'm probably going to be on that one. I am having my interview for it on Monday, so we'll see what happens and if I'm a suitable member of that cohort, because I'd really like to look at that intersection. And one of the things I want to do with MMA, and I was talking to Scott about it a while back, is to look at actually putting together training around the use of meditative practices to actually expand and maintain and further explore integration post a dosing session, and being able to give those tools to participants, and also being able to have, make sure practitioners have those tools as well, so that they can actually be with participants in their experience in a way where they're very familiar with the older state of consciousness from a non-tripping experience. So when they're not actually, the practitioner themselves is not actually obviously in the dosing experience, but they can access that state of consciousness. Because for me now, if I want to access a transcendent state, it's not super effortful to get there. And so for me to actually be with somebody who's in that altered state is not as there's not a bigger gap as there would have been for me prior to me engaging in this transcendent meditative space. Does that all make sense?
Absolutely. Yes. And I don't know if you want to, because of the experience of through meditation having the altered state, I don't know if you wanted to connect that back as well in terms of how that experience has been for you, altered states through your meditation.
Yeah, I can. I think we've got lots of browser tabs open, and I'm trying to be, you know, truthful to the question you asked me to start with. So I'm happy to go. You direct me whichever direction you want.
You know, you keep going. You go. It just the probably you had just mentioned in terms of the I think it, yeah, just if you can, in terms of the you were talking about the psychedelic, that being able to
Reset.
reset. So maybe go back to that.
Yeah, so that's one of the browser tabs. So we'll go back to that one. And that's why I disclosed about being psychedelic naive, right? And what I've seen in some of the video recordings of dosing sessions, and what I've read a lot in the literature, and there's been a lot of reading for me in engaging in this space, is that that's essentially what it is. It's that being able to just explode out all of those locked in set neural pathways, and so essentially just like the big bad habits of the brain, and it suddenly gets exploded open. You've got this really plastic space for a while where those new habits that we're talking about, where I'm saying you need to brainwash yourself by listening to Sarah Blondin every, you know, 5 minutes, that's more of a bam. Within the space of a very short period of time, you've got this neuroplasticity that allows this fundamental change within your brain structure, within your psyche structure. And so the blessing in psychedelics is suddenly you've got this exogenous capacity, like just you've got a pill that you take, and then that pill says, here, you be neuroplastic. And now we're saying, great, so let's make the container that is receiving that neuroplasticity as amazingly supportive and targeted as is appropriate for this person. So we're getting this beautiful situation where you've got two therapists working on things that the client themselves has identified in the preparation sessions. And so the therapist and the client can then take that and integrate that. But we've got this person 2.0. So person, one here, 1.0 before the dosing session is preparing, preparing, preparing. They go on this beautiful dosing arc where they've gone down into like dissolution of self, and they're, having all of the dosing session experiences. And when they come back up out of that, they've done the deep dark night of the soul in whatever version that is, or they've transcended to the heavens, or both in various points during the session. And when they come out, they're 2.0 version of themselves. In that person then goes back to their daily life, and all of the extraneous pressures of this, and this, there's like they're trying to be kind of slotted back into who they were before in version 1.0, right? And so what we're trying to do is say, how can we make robust the potential changes that have happened here? So we try to help them solidify those changes, make them concrete, and actually sort of operationalize this 2.0 version in the direction that they want, in this new, improved, I suppose, but happier, more functional person that's able to then take that into their daily life. And that's the role that I see that psychedelics can play.
And I think in a way you've been, I know you just communicated about the potential of your own experience in that to further see how your evolution, the evolving self and selves beyond that. It sounds as though you have been able to tap into that through your meditation. So maybe if you are happy to share how do you find, I know we've talked about before we started in terms of states of consciousness and kind of going in that communicating a bit about that. Is there either an experience that you've had? I know I've have a little bit of background of a story that you shared, or not a real life story that you shared, something that kind of conveys your experience with an altered state or
Oh. So, interestingly enough, yes, it's the short answer. I'm happy to share stories around altered states, but the story that you're referring to is not altered state. That's real bread and butter stuff. So, I'm really happy to talk about that if you'd like me to, or altered state. Either is fine.
in the bread and butter of meditation.
Yeah. That's a like any monkey can do what I did. Like. But
Anyone?
I'm happy to share that story, and then we can talk about altered states.
Sounds good.
All right. The story, I don't even know where to start the story, but do you want to tell it?
Well, you were able to, and we talk, when we've started this thread, oh, we have had the thread of the kind of meditation, the idea of being able to go beyond the noise of the mind and even perhaps sensations in the body to be able to steady. Doesn't mean we still, everything is still, but being able to shift our present moment experience. No matter what we might be experiencing. And there was a story that you shared, which was when you were a certain procedure you were having, whereby the general anesthetic, instead of having that you proposed and did a very good job of being able to convey the potential, and then it happened, of being able to perhaps meditate or get into a meditative state while you were having a procedure. And that in itself, I wouldn't say any monkey could do. So I would like to put that back of the ability to, and you've talked about biofeedback, in terms of, yeah, just I find that it's actually a really intriguing part of your story.
Oh, look, fair. Yeah, look, when I say any monkey could do it, it's just because I was attached to this big ass biofeedback machine. Like, they literally, because they didn't think I could do it, I was literally hooked up to a heart monitor. And so there's the beep, beep, beep. So I've got this entire team of people around me, including an anaesthetist sitting at my head ready to go should anything go pear-shaped. And all I have to do is keep my heart within the beep-beep zone and we're all good, right? And so, like, most people can actually entrain their heart rate to something if they've got an external stimulus. And it, I guess it does take practice to a degree. And yeah, it was difficult to do while I'm being cut and stuff like that. And when the local anaesthetic ran out, like, I was like, yeah, that one was a challenge. Like, actually experiencing pain and feeling someone slicing and still keeping the heart rate steady. That took a little
just
bit.
Even hearing that, Megan, just even hearing that you self repeat what you have to listen to what you've just said. So, yes, I am going to say that it was rather, you know, and the reason I'm also bringing it up is because we have so many different life situations. Now, you would have probably said that so many other things that were going on in your life, maybe then or as you've talked about in this conversation, was a hell of a lot harder than that, you would probably say. And yet, with our own how life is, dealing with life and death, as we both talked about, dealing with, you know, marriage breakdowns, chronic illness, in terms of just age and stage, that being able to contend with me listening to you and in listening to these interviews as I conversations as I've had them so far for Mind Medicine Australia, it's unbelievable how much people can endure, can experience. And I don't want to say that hope word, but that there is so much that we actually can then also transcend in terms of being able to go on. Some people don't, and we both, you know, have expressed that today. But even in that, to bring this back around, in that experience that you had as a procedure, in a way, to me, it's like it's a kind of a metaphor for how do we deal with hard situations physically, mentally, and emotionally, and ways in which we can be in a more steady state, no matter what arises. Our present experience can actually be modulated as we want to, as opposed to what's happening around us. And so I think that is the, I find it very, you know, I find it very intriguing, but then also it is around how do we, you know, you did just distinguish between, okay, we can do that. We can learn a practice and a meditation and then be able to be in the world in perhaps hopefully a more manageable way, right? Hopefully even happier, or not necessarily happier, but being able to deal with sadness and loss and all kinds of challenges, and also experience levity and humor and fun and joyfulness. I just saw, you know, your smile just kind of brightened there right away. And I wonder though, because you did just distinguish that is different from an altered state, would you say? And I wonder if you, yeah, to just kind of transition to, you distinguish that very clearly when I said to communicate about that. So I supposedly was thinking more an altered state can be in that meditative way, you know, when you are meditating, or when you are in that, to me, I would say that's an altered state, but maybe you can educate me around that.
I'm just coming all this myself, Deb. So I'm just gonna speak from what I'm learning on the fly. So yeah. That day, when I was talking to the anaesthetist and the neurologist and then the surgeon, in a way, it was an altered state in the sense that I was able to be so calm because, and because I had been meditating all morning, and it's a side effect. You just have your heart rate steady, you just do your stuff, you just stay in the present moment. And by then I was quite good at meditating. And so all I was doing is coming back to the present moment, freak out, back to the present moment, freak out, back, you know, that kind of thing. And I've been doing that all morning. And so by the time they're saying all this stuff about, you know, and you might not walk ever again and that sort of thing, it's fairly distressing, right? And so freak out, back, and just focus on the prize. Now, I was highly motivated to not have that general anesthetic because the whole, I would really like to have this amount of walking that I have, which is not very much, right? But I want to keep it. And so that's a massive motivation there. But if I didn't have the tools of really skillful communication that I learned separate from meditation, then I wouldn't have been able to actually navigate that situation. So this is one of the things where meditation is amazing, but that ability to have biofeedback and engage with that is great, but that calms your brain enough to be a human being. And so it's one of those things where let's meditate so that we can get on with the business of life. And so let's meditate so that we can actually allow ourselves to be the people that we're born to be, not in a rah-rah way, but in a let's get rid of all the shit that we've accumulated as adults, right? Let's remember how to fly. Remember when you were a kid, right? Most people have this, where you have these dreams that you can fly. And for people that can remember that as a kid, they can often remember at the time when it sort of goes away where they're not quite able to fly anymore. But the point where they can fly again as a child, I remember that myself, where it was, I had to just let go. And when I let go, then whoosh, up I would go. And then I remember not being able to do that anymore in my dreams as a kid, right? And so the process that I've had through all of this stuff is basically remembering how to fly, remembering how to let go of enough stuff, let go of all of these heaviness, the adult stuff, all these dramas that we create, all these things, very real challenges in life. Absolutely. You know, the arrow and not the second arrow though. Like, so we've got the pain, but let's let go of the resistance so then we don't have suffering, right? And so that's remembering how to fly. You can fly with arrows in your chest. You can, right? You can do it because then you laugh. And you, like, I went on a dancing thing a while back and I can't even stand up properly, right? So I use my walking sticks. My walking sticks were dancing. And when that went out, I'm like on the ground, I'm on my knees, and I'm literally like dancing on my knees and dancing just using movement. And when it was too tiring because I've got this awful fatigue, I lay down and the music is bumping me up and down. I was like, yeah, I'm dancing lying down. I'm dancing on the inside. My ear cilia are dancing up and down, you know, like, and so you engage with things in the way that you can, so you can fly. Does it make sense?
Yeah, it really does. I think that the notion of the flying, I think a lot of people when we're young, you know, can come to that, and then we lose that. You know, it's kind of like going back to the Buddha nature or you know, beginner's mind aspect. And how do you think that the in terms of people who are interested in kind of altered states and interested in the kind of higher consciousness. And, you know, this isn't the first conversation in this series around, you know, the bigger questions of, you know, who are we? Why are we here? Those bigger questions that some people, I'm included in that, love to think about, you know, get bewildered with, have real challenges with. I just, you know, your beautiful smile again, but it's hard shit too. And, you know, to be honest with you, you know, these conversations, and, you know, it's, you don't have to be a rocket science even for this, you know, conversation, having been born out of, you know, a sister who ended their life, this notion of, you know, of being able to reach what you've just talked about in terms of that kind of some of the, it's like, do have the meditation so we can do life, how we can, you know, get the most out of it, every bit of it. But in that sense of, you know, altered states and the potential of the kind of higher consciousness, and I know that, you know, just especially because I know our time is limited, but is there something around the kind of higher consciousness, altered state that we haven't communicated about that you would like to either share or communicate about of your own experience or just your reflective thoughts around higher consciousness, your own experience in that.
Gosh. Do I want to share? Would I be willing to share? Maybe. Do I want to? I'm not sure. Higher states of consciousness in my experience have been terrifying. When I first experienced a transcendent state for the very first time, was now a couple of years ago, and I was literally just stirring my tea, standing at my bench, and there was nothing mystical or magical about that moment. I was cranky, I was tired, I'd just finished a day of work, I was listening to something that a friend of mine had sent through to me, and I was being the dutiful friend and just sort of just doing it, just getting on. I was standing and I was stirring my tea, and then and this is where I get weird. Okay, so this is the thing where if I start talking about these different states of consciousness, I find that it's really difficult to articulate. And like any, remember how I said, if I'm talking about a client, I think about the client. And so I'm talking about females, when I'm talking about eating disorders, something about a specific client. When I'm talking about this state of consciousness, I'm aware of the fact that sometimes I go a little bit weird because I try to access that memory to talk to it. I think it's a way that I process information. So when I access those memories, I start to feel that and I shift where I'm operating from. And so I get a bit weird. So apologies if there is some pauses or if I shift, but I will do my best to not get weird because I don't like it. I don't want to be a wanker. So let's just, I'll do my best, I promise.
Thank you.
Thank you though. I'm glad you don't see me as a wanker. I think we all are sometimes.
Sometimes the laugh is it's that nervous laugh amidst with a little bit of a release, and then it's like, oh, do we go here? Do we do this? Do we let go? Let's fly.
Beautiful. So I was stirring my tea and there was just something so entrancing, I think, about the whirlpool and the tea. Now, the trigger is not the issue. It's not the I think if I stirred tea again that I would, you know, that was the thing that happened for me on that day. And in that moment, as I looked at it, I became the tea. I became the whirlpool, and then I became all points of time and space and existence. And then it was a paradoxical simultaneous experience of I still had a body, but I didn't have a body. And so I existed as this infinite consciousness, but I was aware of the body and I knew that it was still standing in the kitchen and it was there, like it was intact. And I had a relationship to that body. So, I mean, I guess irrelevant is a way of saying that the body was irrelevant, but obviously it was relevant to a degree. And so I maintained that state of consciousness for a period of time. And then I freaked out. And then I went and lay down and freaked out some more. And then anytime I thought about that for a while, I can still feel the fizzing here just from talking about it. But anytime I thought about it or somebody asked a question or whatever, if I would go there, my eyes would flutter, I'd be gone. And I was inhabiting that transcendent space. And so I freaked out more. So I went to my neurologist because I have MS. I have a neurologist and I had an appointment coming up and I said, I have a brain tumor. I must have a brain tumor. Like something's not right. And she's like, okay, well, and I said, I need an MRI. And she's like, well, you've got one coming up. why do you think you've got a brain tumor? And I said, well, I've been having all these weird experiences and now my vision is different. I used to have like depth perception in all these different ways, but now I can see everything all within the one particular field, and I'm trying to explain all this stuff. And she's like, what the fuck is going on with this person? Like, and so they're probably thinking psychiatry referral. So then I stopped talking and stopped sharing these things, right? And she's actually lovely. And so, unsurprisingly, on the MRI, it was just, spinal lesions and brain lesions and all the things that go with multiple sclerosis. But there was no brain tumor because actually I'd had a spiritual experience, not an organic problem within my brain. And so, after that, and partly during that process, a friend said, that sounds like your Kundalini woke up. And I'd heard about Kundalini. Like, I'm not trying to be like, I lived in Byron Bay, man. Like, I've heard about all this stuff, right? And I learned meditation when I was 17, but I've never read into it all. Like, I've sat Vipassana, so I know the teachings of Goenkaji. So I'm aware of these things, but not in a deep sense and not in a Kundalini waking, any of that sort of stuff. So I didn't know what was going on, and I was terrified. Then I started to try to explore it a little bit. I also started drinking a lot because I was just like, what the fuck is going on? And so I had a really maladaptive response. Like, I'm the worst person to talk about this stuff because I'm so, anyway. So I didn't have a very smooth or at all graceful or grateful reception to altered states of consciousness. Like, I was all up for the whole let's meditate and have good biofeedback. And like, when they gave me a heart meditation, I mean a heart medication, because they were testing whether or not my heart really was broken. And so they gave it to me and they were saying, I don't understand what's happening. She's tracking along great. She was responding really well. And they said, we're gonna give her this other thing. And I'm like, there, I've been, meditating of sorts because I'm there, I've got my shirt open, I'm lying down, there's these two massive guys, and so I'm meditating so I don't have a panic attack, right? And so then they're saying, well, she was responding to the meds and then it stopped. I'm like, oh, can you tell me what's happening? Oh, you've suddenly hit the ceiling where you're not going forward responding to the medication. Like, what's going on? I said, my bad, maybe. Because this was just after the surgery experience. And I'm saying, I've been meditating so I don't freak out. I can stop. And they're like, yeah, whatever. Look, give her 2 minutes. See. I said, what do you need? Just a disco has to go up by 5 beats a minute more and hold it there steady. I need to take a few pictures. I was like, just give me 2 minutes. And so I didn't have any idea what I was doing. So I lay there and sort of just imagined like I was doing like a spiritual poo kind of thing. I was like, like, can I get my heart rate? It got up and goes, fuck, I mean, she's done it. And so I did that. So I'm not graceful. I'm not good in doing this. It's not like I have a pathway or I know what to do, but it's just that I've got these experiences, right? And then when I got this transcendent stuff going on, that was a whole different ball game and I felt completely petrified. But now that I've read a little bit, which is very weird to read about my experiences, what I actually had happen in these, like, oh, you can see I'm still stressed about it. Like, it's quite embarrassing even talking about it, but it's written there. It's like this shit happens to people. It's meant to. It's what we do as human beings, right? I was just doing my fucking tea. And then we're doing this thing, and like, we've got these transcendent states of consciousness. And so now when I meditate, I'm much more interested in it. And I was really cautious for a while. Only now, as I told you earlier, I meditate like an hour and a half morning and night. And I spend a significant portion of it deliberately sitting in the transcendent state because I want to learn to navigate it. Yeah, I can do it now. Still get terrified, but I do it because I want to learn to navigate it because I want to be a practitioner in the psychedelic state, because I've seen how important this is and how great it is for people. So I want to be a guide that can actually really understand and know that terrain and territory. And I thought, if I'm terrified and I can find a way to navigate that, then I'm going to be developing mad skills that I can then share with people, not necessarily during their dosing session, but afterwards about how we integrate, how it is that we can bring that consciousness into our daily life in a really practical way. So I'm trying to operationalize my spiritual transcendence into practical and fundamental things that I can do in my daily life. Did that answer the question?
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you for actually going to that. Yeah, just thank you for sharing that. To be able to, and you did fine. Not that you need my
It's reassuring though, thank you.
you don't need my reassurance, but I to be able to in to be able to also just to be able to articulate in some way, because it's so many people have said beyond words, which you didn't, you actually were able to, and you even said, you know, I might pause and, you know, because mainly people will just be listening to this, but, you know, and just literally the kind of the little bit of the feeling state that you, as you said, you might, you know, kind of go into, that was just a very, it was a really, important part of this, these conversations, because, and it's the first time in these conversations that someone has been able to do that. And so to go there, and I know that they're, you know, it's so interesting at the moment in my head, because they're, you know, the meditation part and being able to biofeedback, and there's such a kind of a, you know, as you, now I understand why you said any monkey can do it. And I don't believe, though, that you necessarily meant, you know, just for listeners to be able, the practicing of, and to be able, the biofeedback part, as well as viewing the fluctuations in the mind, let alone letting the fluctuations in the mind settle, is its own lifetime of, you know, practice and experience. And I think you would tell me if I'm incorrect, but I think you would agree with that. But what you were also saying is that to go from that, and I think people talking about altered states and listeners, even as I said, please educate me, you know, as someone talking about it, to really kind of, that there is some differences there. And you just really were able to have a conversation about both. So thank you very much. I thought, and I don't know to end more in on this topic, whether or not, so it could go two ways, and we've done this the whole time. I love that you were saying the browser is open. I want to ask if any other browsers that you had either in your head or jotted down that you wanted to share. And then if there were, was anything else around, I keep hearing about not, I have this conflict with hope, because I say the word hope a lot. I think that to have hope in life, for me personally, where I am, is an important part of my being. And yet I hear sometimes that hope can be the facade of kind of fantasizing, you know, in terms of what we want in the world. I hope I could have a better relationship with my parents, or I hope I could, you know, this. And so I'm being honest in my, I'm working with that myself, but I wonder, do you have hopes in your own words, you can, around kind of this service system and or any other browser that you would like to communicate? I just wanted to, as a psychologist, as you going into also this field, this new field, really, well, it's an old field, but a new field in certainly in the Western countries. Yeah, just anything around the either service system and or the browsers that are open still. And anything you'd like to share.
So with the browser tabs open, I feel complete. I don't feel like people need to know anything more about me at all. Regarding psychedelics and the Australian landscape or international landscape, I'll start with Tasmania. So I recently had a meeting with some Tasmanian therapists, all CPAC graduates, and they were talking about the fact that there are a couple of psychiatrists here in Tasmania that are going for AP status. And so they approached me and I said, yep, I will be part of this team very happily. And so we're actually looking at trying to work with DBA. So I really want to work with, I love the idea of working with a larger organisation, so that when you're somewhere like Tasmania, where we've got to have basically hospital-based facilities or the equivalent of hospital-based in order to run a clinic that's like a private clinic, like it's something separate from a research trial, then to go through a major organization seems like a really super smart move. So having been part of that, I feel pretty excited about that being like a starting point for general community to be able to access this. And I think it would be incredible if Tasmania, and it's going to be the north of the state, that never happens. The two other people are from Hobart, and they're like, "We'll come to you. We need you. We're coming to the north." I'm like, "Oh yeah!" And they were quite excited for something to be in the north of the state instead of this. We're very divided here. There's the
Hobart.
north
We're
and south.
talking about Launceston, Hobart. We're talking about Tasmanian inner politics here, for anyone listening
Yeah,
who is.
exactly right. So north of the state versus the south of the state. Now I'm in the north. So that was really lovely, and I would really like to see that where we're actually we'd be servicing a group in need, so veterans, and that would be incredible. So because I always had a little bit of a tension inside myself of it, this idea of these boutique clinics where people that are very wealthy are able to access these psychedelic experiences for their almost worried well level of mental health, and they're getting through loopholes. That was my fear and worry. And so to have the idea of that I'm being asked to be part of something where ideally we'd be working with veterans, that was my happy place. So that's what I want. I want more of that. If we can do that, if we can get that happening here or anywhere else in Australia, if they can do that and get that happening where they are, let's all communicate and work out what worked and didn't work. What were the sticking points? How can we somehow work with DVA or an equivalent organisation to get it over the line so that people can access this medicine, which has so much potential, particularly for the PTSD. The efficacy rates on that are just absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah. And for people listening, the AP is the authorized prescriber. That's what you were meaning, right? For the psychiatrist, right?
My bad with the acronym.
No, that's fine. Well, that sounds really promising. And I know that equity is a, one of the topical aspects, especially in Australia. So that is interesting. Well, maybe we can come back and talk about some of the experiences you've had in time to come, as both having your own experience, but also in supporting others. Is there and just before we finish, coming full circle back to connection. Having conversations about topics related to well-being, like we use these words. I mean, it sounds so, I don't know, in some ways it sounds trivial, like, oh, our well-being, and what how the distinguishing between mental health and overall health. And I have a hard time myself in terms of how do we communicate about better communicate and have conversations around wellness and wanting to be well and what tools, what you talked about pharmaceutical medicine to therapies to obviously, with meditation, it's been the thread through this particular conversation, which is, great because I love talking about that, and you've taken it to a place that, hasn't been spoken about before. So, thank you again for that. Is there anything else? I know you said you had kind of open. Hadn't prepared. You didn't need to prepare. You have an incredible. You have this incredible. You have had an incredible life experience and experiences, and in some ways self-deprecating to hear you, and then the smile comes again. You have, there is this a real there's a force of nature within you, and it's nice to be able to unpack some of that, and you being so open. I have these conversations most times, haven't met or conversed to a great degree, and to have the humility, the bravery. I feel like I'm going to get upset now. To reflect, you're reflecting back a really strong and very lovable and very tenacious human being. So thank you for having the conversation, and thank you.
Likewise, back at you. Thank you so much, Deb.
All right. Next, till next time.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Mind Medicine Australia podcast. As a listener, you are very important to us. If inclined, we would love for you to follow the show, which just means wherever you listen to your podcasts, press the button follow, and that way you will be updated with each and every published episode. Lastly, if inclined, we would love for you to leave us a 5-star review. That way it's letting us know that we are meeting the needs of everyone who is listening. Thank you very much.